Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everyone. Okay, we've been studying the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta, the Greater Discourse on the Destruction of Craving. This is Sutta number 38 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And last time, just shortly before we ended, I brought in the forward exposition on dependent origination. This is on page 353 at the bottom of the page, in paragraph 17. But if you didn't get it last week, don't worry, because you're going to get it again and again in what follows, from one angle and another angle. So we go over it again in reverse sequence in paragraph 18. You see, in paragraph 17, the Buddha just takes it straight through in forward order, beginning from ignorance and then ending in old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And he just sets it out as a straight sequence of factors, one conditioning the next. In paragraph 18, he takes each pair of factors in their conditioning relationship, beginning from the end of the series, that is, with birth in relation to aging and death, and then taking each pair of factors, he asks the monks whether they understand this relationship, or whether they can affirm this relationship or not. Okay, so we begin with birth as a condition for aging and death. So we can see quite clearly that without birth, there could not be aging and death. And we have this stated or elaborated in the Great Discourse on Causation, the Mahanidana Sutta, where the Buddha says, to explain how birth is the condition for aging and death, he says, if there were absolutely and utterly no birth of any kind anywhere, that is, birth of gods into the state of gods, of spirits into the state of spirits, of human beings into the state of human beings, of animals into the state of animals, and so on. If there were no birth of beings of any type into any state, then in the complete absence of birth, with the cessation of birth, there could be no aging and death. Okay, so this is how birth is a condition for aging and death. Okay, then the next factor is not so immediately clear, how being or existence, bhava, is a condition for birth. Okay, what is meant here by bhava, being or existence? Is the karmically active side of existence. This is the side of existence in which we create the karma that will project or we create the karma that will manifest a new state of existence in the future. We create the karma that will precipitate a new state of existence in the future. So this karma can be of three types. That is, karma which is productive of sense-sphere existence. That is, any of the ordinary types of wholesome and unwholesome karma that we perform. Or it can be karma which is productive of existence in the form realm. That is, the attainment of the jhanas. Or it can be karma that is productive of existence in the formless realms. That is, the attainment of the formless meditative states, the arupa meditations, the formless meditations. So these states of karma, these states have the force, the power to create a new state of existence in the future. And so these karmically active side of existence is the condition for birth into some one or another of these three realms of existence. So in this way, being or existence is the condition for birth. In the Great Discourse on Causation, the Buddha says, if there were absolutely and utterly no existence of any kind anywhere, that is, no sense-sphere existence, fine material existence, fine material existence is form-sphere existence, or formless-sphere existence, then in the complete absence of existence, with the cessation of existence, would birth be discerned? That's the question, and then the answer is no. And so birth, in this way we can understand that existence is the cause, the origin, the condition for birth. Okay, so then the question comes, why do beings engage in these actions by which they generate karma? And so then the answer is given by the next relationship. With clinging as condition, there is existence. And so it's through clinging that one engages in these activities that create the karma that brings forth a new state of existence. The Buddha speaks about four types of clinging: clinging to sense pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. And he says in the Great Discourse on Causation, if there were absolutely and utterly no clinging of any kind anywhere, that is, no clinging to sense pleasures, no clinging to views, no clinging to rules and observances, no clinging to a doctrine of self, then in the complete absence of clinging, with the cessation of clinging, there could be no existence, that is, no creation of karma productive of a new state of existence. Okay, then the question comes, why do people cling to these four types of clinging? Then the answer comes, with craving as a condition, there is clinging. And so because people have craving, they cling through one of these four types of clinging. And the Buddha elaborates in the Great Discourse on Causation, he says, if there were absolutely and utterly no craving of any kind anywhere, that is, no craving for form, sound, smells, tastes, tactile objects, or mental objects, then in the complete absence of craving, with the cessation of craving, there could be no clinging. Okay, and so clinging occurs because of craving. Then craving occurs with its object, feeling. Feeling is the kind of stimulus for craving. And so we say that with feeling as condition, craving arises. The Buddha explains in the Great Discourse on Causation, if there were absolutely and utterly no feeling of any kind anywhere, that is, no feeling born of eye contact, no feeling born of ear contact, no feeling born of nose contact, no feeling born of tongue contact, no feeling born of body contact, no feeling born of mind contact, then in the complete absence of feeling, with the cessation of feeling, then there could be no craving. Okay, then, feeling is the condition for craving, and feeling arises through contact. That is, feeling is that aspect of experience by which we are able to, we say that we experience the tone of the object as being pleasurable, unpleasurable, or neutral, neither pleasant nor painful. But feeling arises because contact takes place. And what is contact? Contact is the meeting, the encounter of three things. It's the encounter of consciousness with an object through a sense base or sense faculty. And so when this contact takes place, this meeting, this encounter of these three things, then a feeling is experienced. And so feeling has contact as condition. And what is the condition for contact? The condition for contact, here it's called the sixfold base, but in more better, more simpler to understand it as the six sense bases, the six sense faculties. What are these six sense faculties? The eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And so it's through these six sense bases that we experience the world, that the world becomes present to us. And then these six sense bases, as we experience the world through the six sense bases, one particular feature of the world stands out as especially prominent. Or at least the Buddha has focused upon this one particular aspect of experience, and that is feeling. And he's focused on feeling because feeling is, call it the lure or bait that draws us through craving. And then continuing back, what brings these six sense bases into existence? And the answer that the Buddha gives is something a little mysterious called nama-rupa, which is translated here mentality, materiality. We don't really have words like that in ordinary English. These are almost artificial words. Translated literally, nama-rupa would be name and form. Name and form was an old Brahminic expression that was used in Vedic texts before the time of the Buddha. It's used in the Upanishads, at least, as a way of designating the way the world of multiplicity, the world of diversity, can be subsumed under these two headings. Rupa is the aspect of everything that appears outwardly is rupa, form, manifestation. And then nama, name, is the way the mind conceptualizes the form that appears, labels it, designates it. And so the Buddha took over this expression from Brahmanism and gave it a meaning within his own system. And within his own system, the Buddha used nama-rupa as a designation for what we might call the psychophysical organism, excluding consciousness. That is, the psychophysical organism, it includes all aspects of mental functioning except consciousness and the material body, the physical body. Though occasionally in the suttas, nama-rupa is also used to designate the world of appearance. That is, rupa also can designate outward form, external form. But most typically it signifies the individual human being, or the individual living being. And when we come to this section of dependent origination, it's nama-rupa is particularly understood to be the living organism in the stage of development within the womb as that organism is taking shape within the womb, before it comes out into the world. Though, of course, it also designates the living being within the world after it's come forth from the womb and is now a person, a human being within the world. But when it's said that nama-rupa is the condition for the six sense bases, the way we understand this is that nama-rupa is the psychophysical organism taking shape within the womb. And then as that living organism begins to take shape from the very early stage, early developmental stage, gradually the six sense bases emerge and develop. In the earliest stage, what would be, in modern terms, we would call it the stage immediately after fertilization, the first stage of the, I think it's called the zygote, there would be present just the body base of the six bases, just the body base and the mind base, the kayayatana and manayatana. But then as the organism, as that cell begins to divide and subdivide over and over, then gradually the cells become more specialized in their function, and then certain cells will take on the specialized function of seeing, and those cells will turn into the eyes. Other cells will take on the specialized function of hearing. Those will become the cells of the inner ear, which are capable of receiving sounds. Other cells will take on the function of smelling. Other cells, the function of tasting. So in this way, the other sense faculties emerge and mature within this process of embryonic development.
Why does this exclude consciousness?
Because consciousness is the condition for name and form. Now, I should mention that in the commentary way of explanation, sometimes name and form is used simply as a designation for the whole organism, for the whole living being. In that case, then consciousness would be included within nama. So it's not really a contradiction between the commentarial way of explanation and the sutta way of explanation. It's just that in the suttas, we usually come across nama-rupa in the context of dependent origination. And in dependent origination, consciousness is shown as a condition for nama-rupa. So in that case, it wouldn't be included in nama-rupa. Okay, so then we have this living being now taking shape within the womb. So then the question arises, what is the condition for name and form, or mentality materiality, or the psychophysical organism to take shape in the womb and to start developing and maturing? The answer that the Buddha gives is that consciousness is the condition for name and form to arise and mature. In this discourse, it's given very concisely, but we need the great discourse on causation gives it somewhat more elaborately. Okay, here the Buddha explains, he says, with consciousness as condition, there is name and form, mentality, materiality. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood in this way. If consciousness were not to descend into the mother's womb, would name and form take shape in the womb? Then Ananda says, certainly not, sir. Then the Buddha says, if after descending into the womb, consciousness were to depart, would name and form, mentality, materiality, come forth into this present state of existence? That is, would it come forth as an individual living person? And the answer is certainly not, Venerable Sir. Then the Buddha says, if the consciousness of a young boy or young girl were to be cut off, would name and form, mentality, materiality, grow up, develop, and reach maturity? And the answer is certainly not, Venerable Sir. And so then the Buddha says, this is the cause, so therefore this is the cause, the origin, the condition for mentality, materiality, name and form, namely consciousness. Okay, so then the question arises, what is the condition for consciousness to appear in the womb? Why is it that consciousness takes the particular, acquires the particular nature that it does? Why is consciousness, why does it descend into this particular womb? Well, why does consciousness appear in this particular state of existence rather than that state of existence? The answer the Buddha gives is that with the sankharas as condition, the sankharas are the formations, but what this word means are the volitional formations, or we might say the volitional forces as condition. Consciousness appears or consciousness arises. So it is these forces of volition, the individual acts of volition, that create this generative force, this creative force, constructive force, that has the power to propel consciousness into a particular state of existence. And these volitional forces we can say that they inhere within that consciousness as it arises, even in that first moment of consciousness that arises in the womb, or sometimes springing up spontaneously, fully formed within some state of existence. All of those volitional forces that have been generated in the course of our past life, and the lives before that, and the lives before that, going back hundreds and thousands of lives, all of those volitional forces are, in a sense, inherent within, or acting upon, or at a subtle level conditioning the arising of consciousness from moment to moment. And so in this way, these volitional forces are the conditions operating upon consciousness. Though they are not, I have to say, that they're not determining forces, in that consciousness is not completely, absolutely determined by the past volitions. But at any moment that is in our active waking life, we have a power through our own decisions, our own resolutions, our own choices, to change the course of our lives, of our consciousness. But still there's this huge backlog of our forces of previous volitions always in the background acting upon the mind. and bringing into the present, manifesting in the form of karmic results with which we have to deal in our lives. And so many of the events in our lives are ripenings, fruits, manifestations of this huge accumulation of volitional forces. And then we respond to these manifestations of past karmic forces by making new decisions, new choices, which generate new volitional forces. And those new volitional forces will govern our destiny in the future. Then the Buddha asks, what lies behind this process by which the volitional forces, the volitional formations, bring forth consciousness from one life to the next? What is it that underlies this constant fermentation of volition? What is it that is constantly igniting the will to generate these volitional forces, whether wholesome, unwholesome, good or bad actions? That underlying, deep underlying condition is ignorance. Avijja, ignorance, which means not understanding the true nature of phenomena, not understanding the three characteristics of existence, not understanding dependent origination itself, not understanding the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so now at this point we come to the beginning of the series, when we go in forward order, with ignorance as a condition for formations. Now before I ask for... Well, actually I'm going to do the systematic presentation, but first I want to do the recapitulation on arising. Okay, after the Buddha has gone through this questionnaire with the monks, now he does a recapitulation. He says, good monks, he says, you say thus and I also say thus. And now the Buddha states the underlying, what we might call the underlying structural principle of dependent origination. This is a principle that is not tied to any particular formula, but it's simply a principle. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. I like to write it in Pali. It's nice to know. See, because of the use of the locative absolute, one could use the same pronoun in Pali, and one will understand that it has distinction of this and that, whereas in English we have to use two different pronouns, this and that. So, imasmin sati, that's the locative absolute. When this exists, imas. Idang hoti, that comes to be. Imas upada, with the arising of this, idang upajati, that arises. Now this principle, this is, you might call this the abstract principle of conditionality. This can be used in many different ways. In fact, the Buddha uses this in the suttas to explain different aspects in the functioning of society. Even in the Mahanidana Sutta, the great discourse on causation, he uses it to explain how kind of social chaos and social disorder arises through craving leading into attachment, into possessiveness, into suspicion. Then it leads to conflict, quarrels, disputes, and then into complete social chaos. Other suttas apply this principle of conditionality, well, in many different ways. So it's not tied just to this 12-factored formula that we know as dependent origination. But usually, because the Buddha is concerned with primarily with the problem of bondage to samsara and how to achieve liberation from samsara, he usually exemplifies this principle with the formula of that we know as dependent origination, the 12 factors, or sometimes 10 factors, from ignorance to old age and death. And so here he exemplifies this principle with the forward order, that is, with ignorance as condition, there are the formations, with formations as condition consciousness. And so then he goes all the ways down from to with birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Okay, maybe I should just pause and then ask if there's any questions on the explanation that I gave of the sequence of the factors. Yeah. Dr. Murray?
I have a question about necessary versus sufficient. I guess, for example, consciousness is not determined necessarily by past volitions in the sense of present action, but it would seem to be determined necessarily that it should take form, and that, and so that there would be it might be a sufficient condition in one context and only necessary one in the other. Am I making sense?
Let us say, I would say it's a necessary condition. Maybe I have to go over that again.
Are any of these connections sufficient conditions?
Okay. I'd say certainly birth is a sufficient condition for aging, and birth is a sufficient condition for death. Not necessarily for aging. Well, in a technical sense, you could say birth is a condition for aging and death, since as soon as one is born, technically one is aging, even if one doesn't get up into.
Well, there are stories of people who ascended without dying. I don't know if there are rules in the existing other things. So birth may not be necessary. It may not be sufficient, but only necessary.
Within the Buddhist tradition, in Buddhism, it said that there's no one who is born who is not die, who doesn't die. And even if there are those who ascend without having died yet, according to, from the Buddhist point of view, it would just mean that they are, maybe go from that they've ascended, okay, from this world, say, into a heavenly world, but that they haven't yet escaped death. It's just that their life hasn't yet come to an end in that heavenly world, but that it will come to an end. Okay, so but maybe at this point I'm really asking, my point is to ask if there's anything that needs to be cleared up in my explanation rather than to explore the implications. Yeah, George.
I wonder about clinging and craving.
Yeah.
Clinging has always seemed to me to be redundant. I don't know what it adds that craving doesn't already have.
They're very close, and sometimes it's the difference between them is illustrated by similes, which are not completely convincing. Okay, one simile is given is that craving is like a thief's intention to take a desirable object, like a thief is going to steal some precious jewel. So the thief's desire to take the jewel is like craving, and the thief's putting his hand on the gem, the jewel, and taking it, that is like clinging.
I've heard you describe it earlier as a grasping to an object.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, but maybe tanha, okay, suggests, the word suggests desiring that which one does not possess. It's, the word literally means thirst. So thirst is one has a dry mouth, one needs water, one wants water. So one has that craving for water. So it's something one doesn't have, one wants. One has that craving for that which one doesn't have. Upadana is take, it's based on the word for taking, adana, and upa gives a sense of firmness. So taking and holding firmly. And then the objects given, I think, under upadana, that's why it's specified differently, to show more specifically what are the types of things to which one clings. And then it mentions one is sense pleasures. Okay, there's a craving for sense pleasures too. So the craving for sense pleasures is desiring the sense pleasures that one doesn't have. Then the clinging to sense pleasures is clinging to those that one has, to those things that are objects that give sense pleasures, clinging tightly to them. Okay, but the other three are things that don't come so easily under clinging, under craving. That's the clinging to views. That's like an inner attitude. And it's something that's rooted in craving. It's a craving for a sense of security. Craving for, basically it's a craving for bhava, a set for that continued existence. And so that will generate or lead to the adoption of a view, of certain views that will satisfy that craving, then craving for the clinging to rules and observances, like people cling to, especially these, in this context, it's rules and observances and the belief that these will bring liberation, the purification. These were common beliefs in the Buddha's time. So the beliefs were, if you perform these, especially certain types of ascetic practices, like fasting for certain periods of time, bathing in certain holy rivers, going up and circumambulating certain sacred mountains, exposing oneself to the heat of the sun with four fires burning around one on the hottest, during the hottest season of the year, these types of practices, that this will purify one's defilements and enable one to gain liberation. So the various yogis and ascetics of the period clung to these beliefs and practices. And if these were denied, the efficacy of these beliefs, they became very agitated and anxious. Okay, and then the clinging, the most fundamental clinging, the hardest one to give up, is this clinging to the atavada, clinging to a doctrine of self. Okay, that's something that's different from a craving, though we could see that it's rooted in craving, because one wants to have a sense of self, but then when one comes across a doctrine of self, one thinks that is something that satisfies my conception of my real self. That's what I really believe about myself. And so then one adopts that belief. It's satisfying, gratifying. And then one clings to it. And then one holds to it very tightly. And then if one comes across something like the Buddha's teaching on non-self, anatta, that none of the objects, none of the things within ourself, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, all of this is not self, then one wonders, then what is myself? Then that sense of clinging gets, it's like the rug is being pulled from underneath it. What is there to stand on anymore? Nothing to stand on. Suki? Yeah, he just, in paragraph 17, he just said that. He's referring back to paragraph 17.
So if that's like, I said this, now do you understand, is that what it means, or?
Well, at this point, he's just asking the monks to confirm whether, pretty much, whether they agree with him on these points.
Agree with him or agree with the 12 conditions?
Agree with the statements about the conditions. Yeah. Later he'll ask whether they... I think he asked whether they know and see this for them. No, he doesn't quite ask them directly whether they know and see this for themselves, but I think it's implying, what's implied is that they have known and see, that they know and see dependent origination for themselves. Because that is made clear in the questionnaire on the four nutriments, that they know and see the arising of this has come to be in dependence on the four nutriments, that they're free from doubt about this, and that they have seen this. This is in paragraphs 12 and 13, that they have seen this for themselves with proper wisdom.
At the very end of paragraph 18, I'm assuming this is a typo here.
I know what happened with this. Yeah, that is a typo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in this printing, they reinstated a typo that had been corrected from the first printing. It had been corrected in the second and third printing, but somehow they put that old typo back into this, which is the fourth printing. It's the second edition, but it's the fourth printing. A number of old typos that had been corrected had reappeared in this edition. Okay, I want to go, unless there's an urgent question. Yeah. What is the question?
I just wanted to confirm that in the definition of the being existence section, that you described it as being the karmic side of existence.
Yeah.
That this is where the karma is that creates a new existence.
Yeah.
So by that, I can assume that they're not including all karma in there. There's some karma that doesn't create a new existence in birth. Or is it supposed to mean everything?
Well, I think it includes all karma. I don't know.
I mean, does it depend on how you're looking at dependent origination, whether you're seeing it as going from one life to the next or within one life? Or?
I think it's looking at those karmas which have the potential to create a new state of existence. Not all karmas have that potential. And also I should say, with regard to bhava existence, the way the commentators explain it, they say that there's two aspects to bhava. One is the karmically creative, the other is the passive or resultant side of existence. Now, when it's said that being is the condition for birth, then we have to understand that it's the karmically active side of existence that's the condition for birth. But when it's said that clinging is the condition for being, for bhava, then we can understand that clinging is the condition for both the karmically active side and also for the resultant side, because clinging conditions activities that generate karma, and also clinging itself will lead one into a new state of existence in the future. Okay, this table, I want to go through this table, which I handed out, and some of the classifications here. This table shows the way dependent origination is treated by the commentators in the Theravada tradition. And basically, though there are some maybe minor differences, but there's a great deal of similarity the way dependent origination will be treated by the commentators in the northern tradition, probably going back to Savastivada commentators, whose influence then was absorbed by later commentators in the Mahayana, like Asanga, Nagarjuna Asanga, and their influence remains in, for example, the Gelugpa school in Tibet. And so there's, I would say, a 90% agreement on this way of treating dependent origination. So the division into three periods, I've heard criticism. Some say that this was an invention of Buddhaghosa. No, it goes back even long before Buddhaghosa. It goes back to the period probably even preceding the division of the early Buddha Sangha into different schools. One finds it in works, well, very early works of the Theravada Abhidhamma, Patisambhida Magga, which are distinctly Theravada works, but from a very early period, long before Buddhaghosa. Okay, so the way dependent origination is treated is to take these 12 factors and divide them into three periods. And now this is a word that has to be said, that this division into three periods, I call it an expository device to understand how the 12 factors work as one series. It doesn't mean that ignorance and volitional formations belong exclusively to the past. It doesn't mean that birth, aging, and death belong exclusively to the future. In that case, if that were the case, it would mean that in this life we don't have to undergo aging and death. Then we could all go out and celebrate. No need for Buddhism in that case. We're free from aging and death in this present life, so why worry about the future? But this is just a kind of convenient way to show how these 12 factors are to be divided up and understood to see how they are interrelated. So if we take any given life as the starting point, we call that the present life. And we have the present life beginning with consciousness. Then we look back from that consciousness and we say, what are the factors responsible for that consciousness? And we see volitional formations in the life preceding that, and underlying the volitional formations, ignorance. And then from consciousness, as the starting point of the present life, we have name and form, that is the formation of this being in the womb, the gradual formation of that organism, then the emergence of the six sense bases, the making of contact with the world through the six sense bases, the arising of feeling. Now these, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, these five factors are occurring primarily through the maturation of past karmic formations, past volitional formations. So these are considered to be five present effects. If you look in the far right hand column, those are considered the five present effects. Consciousness through feeling. Now when feeling, as feeling takes place, feeling will stimulate or provoke craving. Craving leads to clinging, and clinging will generate activities, karmic activities, that have the potential to bring forth new existence. So this will be karmic existence or bhava. So these three factors in the present life, the present period of time, are called, these are three present causes. 8, 9, and 10 are present causes. And these present causes bring forth in the future period, the next life, they bring forth birth, and birth will result in aging and death. But now the situation is rather complicated, because in any given life, there's a kind of intermeshing of all of these factors. So that is why, to really understand the way the 12 factors work in any given life, we have to take this last column, where we have what is called the 20 modes, which fall into four groups. Okay, the four groups. First, we have the 5 past causes. So in the past, we have ignorance as causes. We have ignorance and volitional formations. But when we have ignorance and volitional formations, along with the ignorance and volitional formations, we also have craving, clinging, and the karmically active side of existence. Those factors, 8, 9, and 10, were also present in the past existence. They don't belong only to the present existence. And so it's really those 5 past causes that bring forth together the 5 present effects, 3 to 7. Okay, then when we speak about the present causes, 8, 9, and 10, craving, clinging, and karmic existence, along with those 3, we also have ignorance and volitional formations. Ignorance and volitional formations didn't belong only to the past, but they are also occurring in the present, alongside craving, clinging, and karmic existence. And so we have 5 causes in the present. And then, when we speak about birth, aging, and death in the future period, what is it that undergoes birth, aging, and death? Actually, it's really consciousness together with name and form. But I think just to fill out the pattern of having fives and 5 and 5, they also throw in the 6 sense bases, contact and feeling. So we get 5 future effects. That is, factors 3 to 7 are also what is occurring in the future. Okay, so if you look at this, you can work out the 3 connections. You can work that out for yourself. Then the 3 rounds, what we call 3 phases. One is the phase or round of defilements. The defilements are ignorance, craving, and clinging. Okay, that's the most basic phase in this dependent origination. From the phase of defilements, that is what underlies the whole round of existence. But these defilements lead to karmic activities, unwholesome karma and worldly wholesome karma. That is expressed as the volitional formations and the karmic existence. It's the karmic part of bhava. And then the third phase, or third round, is called the round of results. That is 3 to 7, consciousness to name, consciousness, name, and form, the 6 sense bases, contact, feeling, also 10, that's the resultant existence, existence resulting from past karma and defilements, and then aging and death, that is part of the results. And then the 2 roots of dependent origination. There is ignorance, which extends from the past to the present, and craving, which extends from the present to the future. But we also have to understand that ignorance is present in the, ignorance exists in the present, and craving also existed in the past. Also, I think at this point, then I'll stop and ask if there's any questions.
So you keep talking about 10 bhava as having 2 parts. So is the way to understand those 2 parts the karma vipaka there?
Yeah. Okay. One is the karmically creative side of existence, the part side of existence where we create karma, and the other is the vipaka side of existence. It's called actually upapatti bhava. That's the side, the resultant side of existence, that which results from our activities. It's the rebirth together with everything that happens as a result of previous karma in the course of existence. But Debbie.
On the second karma, number 11, the 12th, birth and aging and death,
how come
these two does not appear on the third column anymore?
How come?
The third column does not have anything related to the death.
How come they're not in the last column? They're really represented by the 5 future effects. So they're... I think that they... they're represented by those 5 future effects, but I think... when this formula was made up, the teachers who made that formula, they wanted to have 5 groups, 4 sets of 5 groups. So to have 5 groups in the future, instead of putting birth, aging, and death, they took the 5 resultant groups from consciousness to feeling and put them there.
In other words, for the 5 future effects, they only want to include 5 of them, and 2 more.
And not include?
Not the other, not the 11 and 12, but 7.
But 11 and 12 are understood to, they're understood to be involved with those 5. Because what is being shown is what undergoes birth, aging, and death. What undergoes birth, aging, and death is, it's really consciousness together with name and form. So you don't even need the 6 sense bases, contact, feeling. But just to have, it's for the, to have a neat formula or a neat table with 5 factors in each of the 4 groups, you have to bring in all 5 of them. It's just, we have to remember that these different tables and charts or devices were probably created in the time before texts were actually written down. So they had to use methods by which these ways of teaching could be easily memorized. And so they would make, they would put formulas into groups of so many components in each group, and that way one could memorize them easily. Any further questions? Okay, anyway, it's about time to end. Okay, so we will continue next week with the sutta beginning. From the exposition on cessation, which is really just taking the cessation of all the 12 factors. Okay, so we end by sharing the merits. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavata Chaam Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chaam Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhuta Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chaam Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe